Anyway, so so that's one kind of an example, really, I suppose, of the drawbacks, of the cultural effects of representationalism as a sort of pervasive attitude, sort of underlying set of assumptions. So this is linked, of course, with metaphysics and what I've been saying so far, and we'll carry on saying about metaphysics. So representationalism is the basis of metaphysics. Because basically metaphysical claims can only be built on representationalism, that they're claiming something is absolutely the case regardless of experience. So obviously that the metaphysical claim is, well, it's referring to something beyond that experience, isn't it, to justify it, something which is claimed to be represented. So like the revelation from God that I mentioned earlier.
What about people who say they have an intuitive sense of God, though?
Well, that's where I would distinguish the meaning of metaphysical claims from the meaning of symbols,
okay,
which may be associated with metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
So the meaning of God, per se, the meaning of a statement like God exists, or God gave us this command, or whatever. This is where I think it's important to distinguish meaning from belief. So we could recognise that the building blocks out of which metaphysical claims are made, the symbols out of which they're made, are themselves meaningful because they have some relationship with people's experience.
Mm.
But when you put them together into a proposition making a metaphysical claim, well, it's not that it ceases to be meaningful, but the beliefs which are then being put forward of a kind which can only be dogmatically supported or claimed, that can only work by saying, oh, well, there's something out there which makes this true.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you find it meaningful in this way, therefore it's justified, which is the process of justifying a belief that we find meaningful in the first place as a belief. So one of the things about representational claims is that they must be true or false. You either accept that claim or you don't accept that claim, and if it's only partially true in some sense, then it's not true. That whole picture corresponds to reality in every detail, or if there's something missing, then it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
The picture is false in some respect. Whereas that representation is different, really, from our experience. So our experience is full of uncertainties and increments. In the way things actually strike us physically and through our senses, we can never be sure of what exactly is going on. But we make provisional constructions, we make guesses, we pull things together in various ways. And what we think may be true is true to some extent in our experience, but it's not absolutely true in the way in which representational claims mean that it has to. So what that means in effect is that the relationship between representationalism and the left hemisphere and the ego, which we talked about yesterday, and the false certainties of the ego. So the ego wants everything to be a certain clear way which it's representing for its purposes, which it's set up as the world in which it works, its version of the world, which for the moment, for the left hemisphere, for the ego, is true. So in order to recognise it as false, there's a certain barrier to overcome, isn't there, that the you know, the ego can go through that. You can say, oh, well, but that's false. In which case, that construction collapses and you've got to reassemble a new one. But our experience isn't like that. We, you know, in our experience, we can gradually modify our impressions of things that, you know, come in. So in any process that we experience, like say a feeling of sadness, you know, you can say, I'm not sad, or I am sad, but actually what we'll experience is just perhaps a little degree of sadness, and maybe from one moment to the next it's getting a little bit more, and then it's going down again. And, but very rarely do our representations actually take that into account. Very rarely can we articulate something quite as subtle as we're experiencing. So we've got this sort of clunky, ego-created representation that we're working with. So if you adopt this representationalist view of how meaning works, I think it also stops us recognizing the objectivity of emotions, which I think possibly connects with things Julian was saying last night. So the because emotions function in a way that helps us as organisms. Take a feeling of grief, say, that helps us adapt to a situation of loss. So if we didn't have that experience, we wouldn't be able to face up to the world as physical organisms as much without that emotion. But if you say, oh, well, it's just subjective, that's not really meaningful, which is what representationalism requires of us, then, you know, that puts a barrier, really, from stopping us recognising the way in which actually that emotion helps us address conditions and therefore is objective, in the sense in which I'm using the word. So that's all linked to the idea that values are incapable of objectivity. Obviously, values are seen as emotional, and they're distinguished from facts in representationalism. Which means that ethics, which are all about values, have got to be either dogmatic or relative. So either there's some version of facts, or you're trying to base them on facts in some way which is difficult to sustain under examination, or they're just feelings. Yeah. They're just what your subjective emotions happen to be telling you, regardless of how they might be helping you, you know, how much these values might be helping you to face up to conditions, but regardless of the value they may have in that way. And the flip side of that, apart from devaluing emotion and devaluing values, is to idealise science. So the flip side of that is science is objective. Science tells us how the world is. Science tells us the truth. Which, you know, it's sincerely working towards doing. It's probably doing more than anything any view of the world has so far. It's got rigorous methods and so on. It doesn't tell us the truth. You know, it tells us... you know, something somewhere on the journey towards some sort of truth, possible truth, over the horizon. So that's the kind of idealization of science. I think that can either result in people assuming that science is true and then being, you know, dogmatic about a particular theory, say, or on the other hand, to dismissing it after all. You know, so the god of science is cast down from its position, and you then start believing creationism is just as good. You know, they're both valid. They're both theories after all. Or homeopathy cures people just as well as Western medicine and so on. Yeah.
So presumably that you know it's a metaphysical claim to assume that science ever will arrive at a complete picture of the universe. Yeah. But equally, it's metaphysical to say that it won't.
Indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't know. It's just, all we can say is that it more or less represents, or more or less, is more or less effective at helping us, you know, describe our experience and understand the world.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 Okay. And then, final point on this note about the effects of representationalism is that it can encourage us to believe that our projections are real. So, if you're only thinking in terms of the truth or falsity of what's out there and the meaning of our language as meaning that, something like an archetypal projection becomes difficult to understand. So, archetypal projections are something I haven't talked about yet, isn't it? But it's I won't go into this in detail now, but there's quite a lot of it in my book. If you take an example of a Jungian archetype, say the shadow. So the shadow is basically a projection of what it is we reject, or what it is we feel threatened by, or afraid of.
Yeah.
So if you think about a dark lord in fiction, or the traditional religious view of Satan or something like this, yeah, that's a projection of the shadow.
Darth Vader.
Yeah. Showing my age, sorry.
Yeah, so if you're thinking of, well, let's take the example of Darth Vader then. So the meaning of Darth Vader, what's the meaning of Darth Vader? So from a representationalist point of view, Darth Vader is either true or false. Either there is a creature out there called Darth Vader who is represented by the term Darth Vader, or there isn't. But this sounds like it completely misses the meaning of Darth Vader, or overwhelming 99% of the meaning of Darth Vader, which is the way that Darth Vader relates to our psychic function of the shadow, so that the fears that we experience as organisms, which we then project onto Darth Vader, or alternatively project onto the devil, or onto the boss who won't give us a pay rise, or whatever
Rupert
it is.
Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, exactly. Or David Cameron, or whatever, yeah. So, there seem to be so many people who really believe in their projections, you know, that the government really is evil, or whatever it is. But it would help us so much, I think, to, if we could go through all the implications of, you know, recognising that we create meaning, you know, which would help us recognise that process by which we project meaning onto what we encounter. Mm-hmm.
So the last thing I'll say is, you were saying about grief, that grief helps us, I can't remember what the run-up to it was, but the grief helps us cope with loss. And I thought, it probably does. That, again, instinctively feels right. But how does it actually help? In an evolutionary sense, if someone dies, or, you know, say we're out in the savannah and something dies, why does grief help? Surely just going, right, better get on with it. Wouldn't that be better? I don't know.
But if you're thinking longer term, then, well, supposing you're, if you're in a family group on the savannah or something of that kind, you've got to adjust to the fact that this other person, perhaps you've been working with closely, mm-hmm. isn't there anymore. So your organism has to take this fully on board.
Yeah,
that makes sense. It can only do this for quite a profound shift in the way it operates.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm. I mean, that would make sense, I think, with yeah, the fact that elephants are supposed to grieve and so on, as well as humans.
Mm. And isn't there also a correlation between creatures or organisms that have a higher degree of cooperative function, and you definitely see a correlation between that and grieving, that because you invest in your relationship a lot more for your own well-being. So maybe when someone dies, people often say that you feel that's part of you.
Part of you.
Yeah, and you are, you're mourning, you're filling a hole there maybe in some way.
Mm. I mean, I was watching, I think it was a TED talk or some description, this might ring a bell with somebody, and the person talking described going up to his or her grandfather's room as a 5-year-old and remembering that grandfather was dead. He'd run up the stairs to show grandfather something that he was really proud of and walked into the room, and that was his first kind of recollection and his memory of grief, and he came out with this very angry response and like threw his bricks down the stairs or whatever it was that he made to show his grandfather. I guess it kind of ties in with what I was saying about adjusting to you have to kind of almost like take that person out of your world model. You have to remember that you can't take your bricks to granddad to show him because he's not there to show the bricks anymore. You can't rely on granddad to tell you what to do in the right situation and that kind of thing. Mm. But maybe there's also a process of the reason that doesn't happen instantly. Maybe there's a process of when you're grieving, you're thinking about the person. They're on your mind an awful lot. And maybe what you're actually doing is kind of taking on board all the things that you're not going to be able to go and speak to them about anymore.
Mm.
It's like granddad's not there to ask him, so you have to remember everything that granddad taught you, and so you're kind of internalising granddad.
Just another one, this when I think of the greatest thing I learned from my dad was how he grieved when my mum died. Like, I had a very sort of northern male relationship with my dad before that happened. We bonded by talking about Manchester United, and then when she died, he grieved really well, in the sense that he just let all this emotion really wash through him, and we became very tactile, we cuddled a lot, lots of holding hands, and it really taught me to let things happen to you and let things follow their natural course. And that's something that I really relate to, the sort of meditative process as well, about just, not trying to stop anything, just observe it and embrace it.
And then let it go.
And then let it go. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the idea of emotion being objective, I think a lot of this has to do with the appropriacy of it, isn't it? And so in the kind of situation you're talking about, grief is very appropriate. It's best way of responding to the situation. And obviously there are other situations where our emotions are less appropriate, they're less well adapted to that situation because they've grown up in another situation. Yeah, so anger, for example, might be helpful in creating a burst of energy to get through an obstruction or something. But in most circumstances in modern society, it doesn't help very much. So you've got a maladaptation there, which is to do with, again, being stuck, having a fixed view of what's going on. Mm. So you can get that in emotional terms just as you can in representational terms. It's the relationship, really, I think, between metaphysics and dogma, or dogmatic emotional states. That either of those can be a drag on objectivity, whereas one's provisionality and responsiveness, whether it's emotional or cognitive, obviously a combination of the two, is what's required for objectivity.
Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that the process of integration of meaning is necessarily ongoing because conditions are continually changing, therefore meanings are going to change. Which is one reason that a kind of enlightenment is the goal of spiritual practice is a problematic position to take, because there's an assumption that you arrive somewhere and then
you stop.
Fix things rather than
So it's just not adequate to our experience, because flesh and blood creatures.
So there's a sense that meaningful activity is activity which is constantly addressing this, almost like the inadequacy of our meaning, actually, that we were kind of